Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 827.GE0225, certificate number 53668, naturism.
Doesn't anyone wear any clothes around here?
No.
What? This is a nudist colony.
Thank you for agreeing to record this show in the nude. I think it's really going to help the authenticity.
I really feel like this is one of those episodes where the fact this isn't a video podcast or a produced video show we're at a disadvantage here.
Pixelated omnibus.
I don't think anybody wants to see either of us naked, but we could be showing a slideshow.
Yeah. We still got the weightlifting videos or magazines from last week.
The problem with naturism, of course, is you don't really want to see any of those people.
Well, that's kind of the central thing about naturism. It's not about how you look. It's about just the joy of feeling naked.
Yeah.
Or so they say.
Are you...
Am I naked?
Again? You're not currently naked.
I'm naked under my clothes.
But have you ever known a never nude?
I mean, is that even a thing? I thought it was a joke on Arrested Development.
No, there are people, and I have known a handful who are just like, I'm never nude.
I mean, you see people who are uncomfortable, like even in the bath or the shower?
I guess they're.
You see people who are uncomfortable with their bodies at the beach and you feel bad.
But they would like to remain mostly covered, not with like a sheet with a hole in it, but you know, like they don't unclothe, fully, but also
But they're not wearing jorts in the shower.
No, I don't think so.
That would be the exception to their rule.
I guess I've never asked about their showering, but you know, you're going to have to clean yourself all over. Well, this may be news to some futurelings, but look,
please,
clean yourself all over.
Please, as soon as the show is over.
Although maybe
you're going to feel dirty and you're going to want to clean yourself all over.
Maybe the futurelings that live under the sea are constantly being scoured by salt water and coral, or maybe it is coral, and they have no sense of like washing.
Can you imagine? We were so dry that we would just accumulate gunk and sand all over every day.
Yeah.
And we'd have to get under the water that surrounds you for a brief moment.
Yeah.
To send it on down the drain to you.
Flakes.
To get all those flakes and secretions off of us.
You know, during the mid-2000s resurgence of expensive denim, a lot of denim jeans and stuff you would buy, this is like when people were first paying $300 for a pair of jeans.
Thank you, Stella McCartney.
They would say in the care and feeding of your pants, they would say, if you need to wash them, just wear them into the ocean. Just wade into the ocean in your jeans and that will be enough to like...
And I don't love the idea if you need to wash them. Yeah, you should wash your jeans sometimes.
Well, apparently no.
It's true that you wash jeans and some of the dye comes off. Is that what they were saying?
Yeah, don't wash your jeans. Because what you want is the jeans to develop a patina, Ken. And the hige we've talked about before, where the front of your pants wrinkle in ways that look like whiskers on a cat.
Right.
The Japanese have a name for it.
It's hige.
Hige.
It's hige.
And so you don't want to wash your jeans because you're going to screw up the hige and also...
It's true that I have some Levi's that come with hige, although I didn't know what to call it.
Yeah, don't ever buy those pants. What are you doing? Come on. What are you?
I don't mind the 14? Patina. What's wrong with the patina?
It's fake. It doesn't belong to you.
You're anti-patina?
You can't buy patina, man. You have to earn it.
You couldn't tell. Nobody could look at my Hige and know that I didn't break that in with my crotch.
I 100% can tell. I just don't say anything.
We're getting kind of far afield from naked
what?
People. But how many days? How many days do you think it's okay to wear jeans before you wash them, or walk into the sea in some cases?
Three years,
like the creature from the Black Lagoon.
3 years, you should take your jeans off and hit them hard with a boat paddle, like 5 or 6 times, just to knock the dirt off of it. And then back on.
I mean, sometimes I'll wear jeans on a hot day and I'll regret it.
Yeah, sure.
But like, but they'll need to be washed that day.
Well, yeah, no, you gotta wear your jeans properly. You should have work on your car jeans.
You're saying this is an etiquette issue.
Yeah, the jeans that you're trying to improve the Hige, when you do work, it should be like work when you're changing the oil on your car without a shirt on. To get motor oil on the jeans in the proper way.
I need to consult this weightlifting magazine again to see, help get in the mood of this.
You're supposed to cuff your blue jeans, wear them with motorcycle boots, and not sweat in them, unless it's in a good way.
Even if you're only sweating a little bit, I feel like you're still getting whatever comes off your legs onto your jeans, and you're like, yeah, that's good. That's like oil on a cast iron pot.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's not good. You got to put those in the washing machine
No, I mean, I'm not going to church. I'm just out, you know, wearing jeans.
These aren't my church jeans.
I'm walking around with my Hige.
Have you been following the local excitement around Denny Blaine Park?
I have.
So,
I used to frequent Denny Blaine Park.
Were you clothed?
So Denny Blaine Park is, I should say.
Let's explain to people outside of Seattle and outside of 2023.
Do you want to explain it or should I? Well, because I was a denizen.
Do you have firsthand experience of the scene?
Oh, for sure. So Denny Blaine Park. Denny Blaine is one of the nicest neighborhoods in Seattle.
Unless you're Kurt Cobain.
A lot of big houses. It's where Kurt Cobain lived and died.
You've got some bad memories there if you're Courtney Love.
Courtney Love's making bad memories everywhere she goes.
Denny Blaine is in my ears and in my eyes.
But Denny Blaine is like, and also, I mean, Denny Blaine was kind of an art colony for a while there when big houses were unfashionable and hadn't yet become.
But now it's on the lake, and so there's $25 million houses there.
And so there are some beaches on Lake Washington that are publicly accessible, like Madison Beach and so forth. But then there are a bunch of mansions where you can't really get down to the lake. And then Denny Blaine Beach, which we always call, this is terrible, and I hope no one is offended by this.
Well, it depends on what you're going to say, doesn't it?
But we called it Dykey Key because it was
the LGBT hangout.
That's right. And
let's not call it that in 2023.
No, I guess we wouldn't call it, unless you are a lesbian, in which case you can call it Dykey Key.
You reclaim whatever you want.
But it was a beach, the only beach really on the Seattle side of Lake Washington, where you could go and just do what you wanted, because there's a narrow path between two big mansions, both mansion owners on either side probably thrilled that they are abut this beach.
Hey, they knew what it was when they knew it was a scorpion when they, a nude scorpion when they built a house next to it.
They might not have actually because it grew over time, but it's not a nice beach. It's kind of a rugged grass covered hill.
And that's what keeps people away from it, yeah. Which is what the nude sunbathers like
about. Yeah, and there's a kind of shallow little bay. And so it became the alternative beach back when LGBT communities and rock, grunge, and I mean, it was all a real admixture of people who were living outside.
Yeah,
it wasn't culture.
It wasn't strictly a queer space.
No, not at all.
It was very safe. It was very safe space for LGBT people, but it was just alternative Seattle.
It was all of us, right? And so I was down there during the summer with my crew because you could also smoke pot and you could sit and look all disaffected with your black eyeliner on and never go near the water.
And it was clothing optional, right? It wasn't like...
Well, so that was an evolution.
Oh, okay.
So at first it was just like...
At first it was just go smoke weed.
Yeah, it was just like the rough beach that was only for locals who knew about it. And then at first the naturists were all single men who would come down and just sit there naked, and it was at the time, you know, very gender neutral, or you know, there was a whole spectrum of people there, and these nude middle-aged dudes were an element that was like, okay,
it probably wouldn't be cool to say no.
Yeah, everybody here's doing their own thing.
I wouldn't request it, I guess.
So here they are.
By the way, as we will see, the fact that it's often middle-aged single dudes disproportionately is actually a big problem in nudism over the ages.
Yeah, and so that was the and then this is like...
Were they gay? Was that the scene?
Not necessarily. It did not seem... It wasn't a cruising spot. I mean, it might have been a cruising spot because everywhere was a cruising spot, but it was not... It didn't seem
there
like
were four trees, so it was a cruising spot.
Yeah, it was a spot where, you know, a same-sex couple could go lay on the same blanket in their bathing suits and tan. It wasn't like a hookup spot.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, early mid-90s, these solitary naked dudes were for sure a change.
And you remember when that started. That's interesting. Yeah.
And I remember the women in my life all going like, oh my God, you know, this used to be a great spot and now it's like creepy. And it wasn't, it's unclear whether it was creepy or not. It's just... There's a vibe, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, the people know how creepy they were being, but, you know, there's something to be said for how creeped out the audience felt.
Well, and definitely, like when my female friends became more and more reluctant to go down there because it was becoming, there was then, like, a second creep, that was something I definitely registered, like, oh, okay, well, what's going to happen now? And actually, as same-sex couples became more and more commonplace. Actually, the name Daikiki moved to a neighboring public beach, and it became then...
The lesbian hangout.
Yeah, but very open and public lesbian hangout. And the old beach, Denny Blaine Beach, just got weirder and weirder. And
neuter, right?
Well, neuter and also junkies, but like high-functioning junkies, but junkies that wanted to shoot up in the open air. Junkies that weren't just dying in cafe bathrooms, but like people that, I guess, had money enough to have a car to get to the beach.
They got to the lake.
And so it was much more of a drug scene, and then the nudism really started to happen. And then it was nudism of all kinds.
Because you need drugs. You need drugs to take away the... what do you call it? Inhibitions.
Well, but this was also after Kurt killed himself because he just lived down the block.
And it became a pilgrimage spot for a long time.
Because the park next to his house became like a spot for teens to...
The bench still has...
Sit and smoke, right?
Has graffiti and memorials on it.
But this was also a time when all those houses that were right there went from being $1.5 million houses to $5.5 million houses. Yeah, so the neighborhood also was getting really rich, and so it was complex.
The rich get richer and the nude get nuder.
They got nuder.
It's the way of the world, John.
So I stopped going to the beach probably in the late 90s because, you know, freaky people could go anywhere now. And then I was middle-aged, so how freaky was I?
This all came to a head earlier this month, or, you know, in late 2023 in Seattle. I don't know what era, what epoch you're listening in. But an anonymous donor gave the city money earmarked for a children's playground at Denny Blaine Park.
I can guess.
Did you not know this?
Anonymous donor was. No.
You haven't been following this.
Oh my God, it's got to be one of six people.
Right, so there's a lot of assumption, and we'll have our editor bleep out the name. There's a lot of assumption that it's... A local real estate tycoon.
Yeah.
Who happens to have an enormous house with a very nice dock right there. And as the parties have been getting louder and neuter.
Oh, wait, is he one of the two houses?
Yeah, I think he's a neighbor.
Because the one right to the left.
We'll bleep this out. We'll bleep this name out too.
The one right to the left got, during this period, what the old, you know, cedar shake house got torn down and a multi-layer, like modernist compound got built there, and it was being built for, I don't know, years. And every time you'd go down there and kind of peer over the fence, you're like, I don't even know what I'm looking at.
Like, which is the house here?
Yeah, is this a spaceport? Like, what is getting built here? So, you know, that house is probably worth $1 zillion now.
But you don't know who it is?
Well, at the time, there wasn't an internet.
Yeah.
So it was like, I mean, I guess there are people yelling into their headphones, there was an internet. I was in Usenet. But no, for me, there wasn't.
I was not on Rec Arts Nude Real Estate, so I don't know.
So who knows who's over there, but that house might have also changed hands 16 times.
Anyway, the suspicion among Seattleites, especially those young or bohemian enough to still be using that space.
And also suspicious.
Yeah. Perhaps some of them are using drugs that make them suspicious.
Yeah, part of them just believes that late-stage capitalism means XYZ.
I mean, it's not like... you know, nothing good happens if you drop in a $25 million house next to a nude beach.
That's true. It's probably not George Soros, though, just for our listeners who might be thinking that's what it is.
That's correct. There is no none of those overtones. But the assumption was that, you know, somebody, a local wealthy NIMBY, thought that my turning that space into more of a manicured family-friendly space, that the craziness of the parties and perhaps the level of nudity next to his boat dock.
There are only two people that care. But also,
it's a
terrible place for a children's park.
That's what everybody pointed out. First of all, there are better places in the if you wanted to put a playground in the neighborhood on the merits, there's three better spots. And, you know, when they opened it to City Comment, it was amazing how many people were like, this is our space. Even if it was only unproven suspicion about what the agenda was here, it was clear that the outcome would be we would be losing our safe space to be naked by the lake and smoke weed on a hot day.
If I had been following this closely, I think I would have chimed in with exactly that. Like, there needs to be one place where it's just unregulated enough. Nobody can get into any trouble down there. It's just a little place.
And they were there before the millionaire built his boat dock.
Absolutely.
So,
and I don't remember, when I first arrived at that beach, it was already absolutely this kind of space. Like we didn't have the term safe space, but that's what it was. By 1990, it was this. So who knows? It might be back to the 50s.
I mean, you build a McMansion next to the airport, and you can't act surprised that there's flight noise, you know?
Yeah, right.
And in this case, I think there was an overtone. And I was not surprised to hear like old school Seattle people sticking up for what used to be, you know, fun and weird here. But I was surprised at the at how gay the commentariat was. You know, mm-hmm. the idea that it's it would be homophobic to build a playground here because of the association of LGBT Seattle with nude sunbathing. Which I guess naively had not occurred to me. I guess I would have thought there are gays and straights who want to smoke weed naked and gays and straights who don't. And just by the numbers, it's probably mostly a straight space, but welcoming. But it turned out in this particular case, now the makeup of that park is largely, this is where you can sunbathe naked and be gay.
Did no one say Daikiki in all of this? It was citywide.
Only you have the guts to still be saying Daikiki in 2023.
Well, now this is an interesting thing because I was just talking to a guy at the university who he's part of the group that runs the Arboretum. And the Arboretum is a very big park here in Seattle that's both a showcase for plants around the world and also kind of a massive forested area.
It's right across the Montlake Cut from University of Washington, which administers it.
But it also is funded by this group and
Citizens
funded by
group, yeah,
this
yeah.
and that. And I
walk my dogs there.
And he's been working there for 20 years. And I said, look, I am very invested in the Arboretum and I have a lot of strong opinions about it. And thank goodness I'm cornering you at a party because now we can talk about trees and the Arboretum.
He's backing away.
And at one point I said, just kind of offhand, well, for me, when you closed the upper road, it really changed the dynamic of the park.
But you see why they did that. Commuters were cutting through.
Well, commuters were cutting through, but then he said it was a massive cruising spot and open-air drug market up there. And so when we closed it, initially we closed it just for construction, but then we realized we had stopped this whole, like, really pretty seedy use of the park.
Keep the Arboretum weird, man.
But in the course of the conversation, I realized something, which is Volunteer Park and the Arboretum, which were both gay cruising spots for decades, you know, since the 50s. If you go to those parks now, all the trees are limbed. The lower 10 feet of all the trees have been pruned. So the branches of the trees all start up above your head. And when I first moved to Seattle, those trees all had branches to the ground. And the areas under the trees were where, in a pre-gay rights universe,
those had been used for liaison.
That was, and you know, Volunteer Park after dark and the Arboretum were both areas where gay cultural, you know, life had certainly had a presence there.
It was North Acres Park in the North End. That's the one I know about.
Right. And so the idea of gay culture being transacted in parks, when all those trees got limbed, I don't remember it being like that there were protests.
But that's hostile architecture to keep.
Absolutely. It was the end of park cruising.
Hostile tree architecture.
But that coincided with mainstreaming of gay culture with, you know, like internet.
Right.
I mean, it's all been transformative. It wasn't always going to be this 19th century Tom of Finland hiding under trees energy.
But some people miss the illicit thrills.
And so this park, you know, I mean, there used to be a lot more public space in a city where you could be,
right,
you know, openly gay out in public, but not surveilled.
I mean, today, you know, given again that there's more acceptance, more, you know, more legitimacy, you don't have to get forced into obscure forests. It's an interesting tension because, as we'll see, you know, the protests of naturists and nudists over the centuries have always been that this is about health,
yes,
and it's not sexual, and please stop layering that creepy layer onto our fun, healthy lifestyle, you creeps.
Shouldn't you be saying all this in a German accent?
You creeps?
Why, it is nature. It is what we do.
This story does begin in Central Europe. You know, the story of naturism begins with, I mean, people have always been skinny dipping and nude sunbathing. John Quincy Adams, I think, famously liked to walk into the Potomac nude every morning. Hmm. And, you know, people would pass and he'd be like, it's with shrinkage.
Make America great again.
But the idea that there would be, that this would be a social thing or that there would be gatherings for it is mostly a turn of the 20th century phenomenon, which we owe to the Lebens reform, living reform of the German and Swiss, you know, of the Teutonic peoples around 1890.
And we've talked about this.
To nature.
Yeah.
I think many omnibuses have their origin story in mid-century Germans being fed up with their unhealthy cities.
Right.
You can't go back to nature in a time when everybody's in nature.
But even Tom of Finland is sort of, I mean, we connected it to this.
Tom of Finland's going to come up here again. Yeah, and I didn't realize until I got halfway through this, I was like, we just did a show about European nakedness.
And I'm going to get to tell my story about the nude beach on the Danube again.
What if you should just say, and here's my story about the nude beach on the Danube.
Well, that's all I needed to say.
And people can go back to, I think it's in the, because we did a show about streaking also.
Yeah.
And that's probably the only other omnibus about public nudity where you could have told the Danube story.
But based on my other podcasts too, and the frequency that I probably tell it every 6 months.
Because
somewhere.
You dream about that.
I do.
Story so often that you have to keep retelling it.
It's the Venus of Willendorf that keeps reminding me.
Well, you know, speaking of dreams, it's funny that in modern, at least American culture, which Europeans is always reminding us is very prudish and Puritan.
Yeah, we put ice in our drinks too.
Nudity is a nightmare to us. You know, it's a common trope that we will have a nightmare that, oh no, I'm in a place where everyone's clothed, you know, school bus, the work, I'm on the train and I'm naked. Ah, what if I just noticed I'm naked? What a terrible thing to forget. Like this is
Did you have this dream?
Do you not have naked dream?
I've had it.
My wife always has teeth falling out dream and yeah. I never have teeth falling out dream.
I've had it.
But I regularly have I'm sitting on a plane and I just realized I'm naked dream or something.
I haven't had one in decades, but I remember when I was a kid having naked dream on a school bus. And This is a story I've never told.
If it's about nudity on a school bus, maybe you shouldn't.
Not on a school bus, but I had an aunt who was a bananas hippie, and she lived in Idlewild, California with her seven kids, all of my cousins. And for some period in the 1970s, she was a proponent of nudity as not just a way of life, but like if you weren't nude, you were part of the military industrial
complex.
Exactly.
It's therapeutic to be nude.
And so I showed up at my grand aunt and uncle's house in Kingston, Washington, and they had a house on the water there. Showed up one time, just coming over. I was probably 8. And I arrive and Mary Ellen is there. And she says, children under 10 are nude in, you know, in this house.
Not will be, but in fact, children under 10 are nude.
And she and Mike and Uncle Al and Aunt Marguerite weren't there. And I was like, I didn't have the power to
advocate for your overalls.
And so I had to take off my clothes and go out with her these nine other kids in the backyard, all of whom were nude. And so we're running around nude, and I am not down with it. But it's the 70s. And, I mean, any kid now would say that I had sustained lasting trauma, but at the time I was just like, well, one more messed up day, and the, you know, like every single day has got a new puzzle.
My crazy family.
And so I'm running around with these other kids, and we're not little kids. You know, we're 8, 9, 10 years old, running around naked. And then I look over, and the neighbor boy is leaning over. He's up on top of some apple crate with his arms folded.
Clothed.
Leaning over the fence, just watching us. And I saw this kid, my age, watching this bacchanalia. And all we were doing is, I don't know what.
You're playing freeze tag or something.
Yeah, we're just you know, trying to make a canoe. And I was covered in shame and turned and ran as fast as I could back to the house, went into the bathroom, went into the bathtub, drew the shower curtain and sat in there.
But this is the Garden of Eden of story. You were happy and innocent in your nudity with your cousins, borderline. Ish. And then you thought, well, there's God over the fence watching me. I gotta go make fig leaves.
That's right. I ate the apple. I'd already eaten it.
So even in our kind of, even with our, the hangups of our religious tradition, there is this idea that there was a time when we were naked and unafraid, and that's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
But you could not have that in Kingston, Washington that day.
No. No, I did not. I could not.
Well, philosophers like, Rousseau and Thoreau, you know, everybody had this idea that that we'd all be happier in the woods, and we were happier back then before industrialization was a thing.
Well, and this was the noble savage too, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, a lot of this does not come from idealizing primitive life. It's really more like, you know, we're not going to turn the clock back, but cities are unhealthy. They're dim and dirty, and I'm sitting on a chair all day. And for a lot of these philosophers they're looking back to, that included, I want to be out in the breeze and possibly in some cases flapping around in the breeze.
What were the last people that didn't wear clothes? It was,
I mean, if nothing else, here's what I always think about nudism. In most of the world, in most of the year, you don't want to be naked.
I mean, I guess in Niger, like there were.
If you live in the tropics, you got options.
Right.
And that's why Borneo, that's why the missionaries coming into the South Pacific were like, hey, look at these kind of Mother Hubbard dresses you guys all have to wear now, because God says God says you have to have muumuus. It's a very weird, specific muumuus friendly commandment he's got.
Yeah, we have all these t-shirts from the Dallas Cowboys Super Bowl of 1998.
But that's like the muumuus that are worn in Polynesia today are very much the descendants of these simple dresses that happened to be in fashion and easy to make at the first time the missionary showed up and said, I can see your nipples, ma'am.
Yeah, right.
But this German recognition that, you know, because, you know, in Central Europe, the not only was the industrialization quick and fast, but also, like, there were beautiful Alps nearby so that you could see the tantalizing, you know, dairy-rich lifestyle that was. And that led to a movement of all these Central Europeans saying, we should have organic farming. We should have natural foods. We should all be vegetarian. We need to stop smoking. We need to get really into fitness. We need to invent homeopathy and naturopathy. So they're kind of inventing these alternative medicines. And sometimes it ties into mystical or Eastern thought. And to this day, as you know, like homeopathy and naturopathic remedies are more accepted in Central Europe than in a lot of other places.
Zurück zur Natur.
Is that how you say back to nature in German?
Yeah.
Nice.
But I mean, I know I've told you about this too, that all that homeopathy in Germany, it's a bunch of hoo-ha.
You don't believe in any of it.
Well, because they try and tell you that they have an antihistamine that works, and it just involves like putting a little of essential oil on the top, on the bridge of your nose, and I'm like, get thee out of here.
My opposition to this, to naturopathy is principled, and yours is based on, you know, it doesn't cure your hay fever.
Listen, man, if you have
you've got experience.
If you have a stuffed up nose, you take your homeopathy and put it in your strudel.
But to this day, in Germany and Austria, there are 3,000 reform houses, which is the name of a, you know, it's the health food store, basically, the homeopath, the naturopathic remedy and organic food store. And it's commonplace there before it was here that you would go to one of these places to get more natural ingredients, because that's the remedy, John, for modern life, for these awful cities that we built in the Ruhr Valley.
And I guess my experience over there is I still consider that some hippie woo. And I think a lot of Germans do, but when they talk to you, even normals,
they have to stick up for it.
Yeah,
because it's part of their national.
They're like, no, you need to, you need to try these tinctures. And I'm like, well, what do you do when you have a stuffy nose? And they're like, well, we can't get antihistamines here because it's against the law. But
well, I mean, it's tempting to think of that these are just faddists, you know, and draw the line to California communes and whatnot. But in fact, it was mainstream. Like this was kind of the way all of society was trending. And so it was just a question of which of your friends were embracing vegetarianism first or were planting vegetables in the backyard. And today we would, again, you know, to go back to the California communes, we would associate this with free thinkers from the left. This would be progressive thought. And plenty of these early German Lebens reformers were socialists. But honestly, when you're talking about a movement where the appeal is, let's go back to the way things were, it's very easy to see how that would be a reactionary movement too.
Yeah, sure.
And in fact, this is the beginning of what becomes Volkische practice in German. You know, the idea that the folk ways were the old ways.
Yeah.
And this is what leads directly to German ethno-nationalism. Like, we were once a strong, fit people out hiking in the mountains, and modern, decadent, depraved, degenerate culture has made us weak.
Yes.
And we need to get back to this.
Yes, depraved modernism.
So in Germany, a lot of this Lebens reform leads to, the worst kind of conservative reactionary thought.
And the worst kind of liberal thought. Wow.
They both come together in Nachtkultur, which is a big hallmark of these free thinker movements were, you got to be naked.
Well, and you know what's really interesting now is because my sister's very woo, or she's woo adjacent, and she was appalled at the number of people who are on the very sort of left and into alternative medicine who became anti-vax conspiracists, and then that
QAnon.
The conspiracy went into QAnon land, and they're now, you know, they're sitting in their integratrons, but are politically indistinguishable from somebody that believes that, the Biden administration is made out of killer robots.
Lizard people.
Yeah.
Well, this happened in Germany in the 1890s. They gave us a little preview of what woo kind of fringe health culture would become in our country.
And if you're listening and are woo, hey, I support you 100%, unless you're anti-vax, in which case I support you less than 100%.
I support you from across the room.
Or in the middle of the room.
Don't breathe on me. So Nachtkultur, or naked culture, also called Freikörperkultur, free body culture, was a real hallmark of these of a lot of these German thinkers from the left and the right.
Yeah.
You know, that part of this back to nature movement would be, you know, strength and fitness, the kind of thing that we were losing in our flabby modern jobs and in our dirty modern cities, that we needed to be out striding through the Bavarian Alps.
Yeah.
And so like an early Lebensreform influencer was a painter named Karl Diefenbach, and he moved his family to an abandoned quarry in Munich, and they all started going naked.
Mm-hmm. In a quarry.
In an abandoned quarry in southern Germany.
Which seems like bad air, bad, no sun.
Yeah, you're going to get shadow a lot of the year.
Yeah.
I guess they would wear like, they had like kind of woven hair tunics that they would kind of wear, like, you know, pelts that they would wear when the weather demanded. But otherwise, he and his son were running around naked, and it was controversial enough that it caught the eye of the courts. And he, in 1888, he was tried for being... you know,
what, prevert.
Yeah, for being perverted behavior around minors, for running around naked with his kid, and you know, gave a stirring defense of the health benefits of being naked in the open air in a quarry, and was in fact acquitted.
And was he referencing prior literature, or was he just like making this up?
I think a lot of it was invented. You know, because you can point back to, you know, Rousseau, but,
yeah,
you know, except for the occasional...
Rousseau kept his clothes on.
Occasional nude sunbathing or skinny dipping, most of these guys weren't writing about the health effects of nudity. This was, and it's self-evident to them. You know, they're writing as if you know, it's you know, there's scientific evidence, but really it's just clear that, you know, we're wearing too many clothes now. And he had a pupil named Hugo Herpner, who wrote under the name of Fetus.
Well, that's weird. I have a protege named Herbert Huebner who writes under the name Fetus.
I guess I should say it's not Fetus like a baby. It's not, yeah, it's not Foetus. It's F-I-D-U-S, like faithful. I guess Fidus in our anglicized Latin.
Oh, so they're clearly different people.
And he spoke of, and he would support this nudity. He went further than Diefenbach and said, there's a political angle. It's important for our Teutonic racial purity to be naked.
Because you can see whether they're circumcised or not?
I mean, yeah, the implication is I don't think he ever specifically talks about circumcision, but the idea is you can see who the most pure Aryans are when they're out of their lederhosen.
How?
Well, you know, who's got the chiseled pecs and who has the curly body hair of the other degenerate races that are sullying our blood. So really the anti-Semitism starts to flow thick and fast with these guys. There's a guy named Richard Ungerwitter, who is actually kind of a proto-Charles Atlas type, who talks about what a weakling he was in his miserable city job. And then he adopted veganism and nudism, and now he takes 10 to 14 hour hikes every weekend. And, you know, there were photos of him sitting up at his desk alertly and nude, coming up with the great ideas that his hard mental work requires.
With one finger in the
air? Yes, because he's having amazing ideas all the time because he's a nude vegan.
This guy sounds like a drag.
And he said that, you know, he also believed that nudism would solve all this racial degeneration. People could find their best, most Aryan matches more easily. And it's easy to see this running afoul of conservatism because it's not Puritan to be able to pick out your mates naked.
Right.
But the little bit of verbal judo that Ungerwitter performs here is he says, no, the problem is clothes. Clothes are so sexualizing, you know? Look how they emphasize the breasts and the buttocks, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like that's what's making us, that's what's making, turning the modern German into a horn dog.
So the clothes make people sexy, whereas their nakedness
is just natural Aryan-ness.
Yeah.
You know, so right. And it's very convincing. Like this works. Another thinker named Heinrich Puder takes this one step further and says, yes, you got to be, if you're a naturist like me, you're going to be hissing at corset wearers on the street because these shameless trollops are squishing their forms to make them seem more attractive to men. And
certain parts of the world, this street hissing is still a big way of communicating.
Oh,
when you think a woman is a hussy.
Yeah, it's there's probably big swaths of America where you can hiss at a corset today.
I'm not sure about hissing. It's quite the same, but
it's because gay culture took hissing away from the Bible Belt, right? Instead they have I don't know what they do. Tut tut.
The Bible Belt?
Clutch their pearls.
No, they go, bless your heart.
Yeah, exactly. You can say bless your heart at women's wearing corsets. Heinrich Puder argues that the unchaste women, I mean, this turns misogynistic very quickly. Unchaste women need to be sunk alive in a bog.
Huh.
Which seems to me, that really escalates quickly.
Yeah, sunk alive in a bog.
He started with hissing at corsets and he very quickly gets to unchaste women should be sunk alive in a bog.
Unchaste by whose definition?
He actually argues that nudism is so essential, it will effectively make people immortal, that it's a cure-all for everything that ails you,
huh.
And that it just hasn't been tried enough.
I don't think that's true. We've tried it a lot, and no immortality. So yeah. It's been disproved
I feel
over
like
the course
in
of
in the
decade.
Stone Age, people were a lot more naked than they are today, and they died, or we'd be surrounded by cavemen today.
Well, wait a minute. Think about all the early Bible characters that lived 900 years.
Because they didn't have... Except we know they were wearing clothes. It's in Genesis, like, 3.
Yeah. I guess.
In 1893, I think, Pudor writes the first nudist book, the first naturist treatise, which is called...
Didn't have covers?
Well, it's often translated as nice. It's often translated as naked man, but I guess that sounds a little gay today. Uh-huh. So to avoid any of those implications, it's often translated now as naked mankind, leap into the future.
Naked mankind. Naked small step for naked mankind.
Because if you have a book called Naked Men, it's going to attract a whole different audience.
Right.
But Naked Mankind really is very high-minded.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy also, you know, he was running an anti-Semitic newsletter called The Swastika as early as like 1910.
Was the swastika already a white supremacist?
He is one of the early thinkers that turns the swastika into a symbol of racial purity.
But why? I think I've read about this a long time ago, but why swastika?
It was just some messed up tradition of how, like, this came from the, you know, the pure Aryans of Eurasia. You know, it predates the degeneracy of Africans and the Jews and so forth. So it's all just bunk history. But if you read his, you know, Pudor was married to a Jewish woman in the 1890s and was writing about bisexuality. And then he quickly divorces his Jewish wife and gets really into anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and nudism.
Sounds like the bisexuality didn't work out.
Well, I'm wondering if there, you know, you could easily write a psychohistory of this closeted gay guy who jettisons his wife and then has to take his anger out on the Jews because he can't come out of the closet.
But when we look back and try and reappropriate past people and say, oh, they were always... gay or trans.
Well,
they always take the good people.
Yeah, it's always like Jefferson was neurodivergent.
Yeah.
Leonardo was gay.
You don't want to. Say like with one more serial killer.
It's quite possible that Jack the Ripper was repressing his homosexual impulses and taking it out on women.
No, that's a drag.
No,
also a drag.
You only want heroes.
So many drags, but not drag.
Exactly.
Because that's degenerate.
That's the opposite of that.
Corsets again.
So there's this, by the 1930s, there are 80,000 nudists in Germany, well-organized clubs and camps and colonies of all kinds. Mm-hmm. It's mainstream thinking that you need to be out in the sun with everything flapping to be a good, healthy, patriotic German. Mm-hmm. And this strain actually does not survive into the Nazi era. Like, people from this Lebensreform movement included Heinrich Himmler and Rudolf Hess and became high-ranking Nazis. But at some point...
Himmler?
Yeah. Himmler comes from Lebensreform.
Was a nudist?
I mean, they're all nudism adjacent.
Well, I have a hard time picturing that.
You should. That's good. Anybody who has a really easy time picturing Himmler naked has things to work on.
I guess so.
But the problem is you run smack into Hitler and Goering, and they had real hang-ups about nudity. And so the Nazi party decides that National Socialism is not just going to embrace the nudism part of these patriotic health reforms. They're going to come out actively against it and say that it's a danger to the modesty of German women and so forth. So Hitler comes down.
So you're saying chastity is Nazi?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, you're going to run into this problem here, where you say, you know, like, I hear a lot of conservatives use this as a talking point against birth control. You know, all the early birth control people were weirdo, eugenicist, racists.
Oh.
And that actually is true to a degree. But that kind of runs into the Hitler is a vegetarian problem where mean that all, you know, all supportive birth control is necessarily tainted by eugenics.
I thought modern conservatives would be like, yeah, it was part of a eugenics,
like they'd be all pro-eugenics at this point?
I thought eugenics was having a real comeback over in the conservative side.
I guess I'm old enough that when I say modern conservatives, I'm actually thinking of people who can articulate an ideology.
Like James Watt or
which,
something.
Yeah, which is not true anymore.
Boy, we're really going after everybody,
aren't we? Do you mean
James
Watson or James Watt? Because they are both problematic.
Well,
conservative voices.
I mean, James Watson at least had a career that was interesting before being a weird crank.
He's the eugenicist. James Watt just doesn't want the Beach Boys to play on the National Mall.
Yeah, James Watt has like a coherent ideology, which is shave the forests and take the profits.
So, but you know, so you're going to run into this fact that, you know, nudity is adjacent to National Socialism, but then the Nazis turn on it. But the problem is by this time, the damage is done. The popularity of German nudism has exploded beyond the Maginot Line and has entered France and the UK and you know, middle-class intellectuals all over the world now, from the US to Scandinavia, everywhere are interested in these ideas of naturism, and dozens of nudist camps and colonies start to appear in Britain, in the United States, in France.
But not with any sort of German association. It's divorced from German.
Yeah, it now seems free of this political baggage, except just in kind of the loosey-goosey woo sense of, you know, let's... you know, it's more leftist now. It's more like, let's have a commune where we can all be naked, man, and get away from all the hang-ups of the man, of the establishment.
So did it also survive in Germany as an underground thing, or did the Nazis successfully suppress it, at least through the Nazi years?
Through the war, I think. But it came back. I mean, I think it's still disproportionately, naturism is disproportionately practiced. I mean, you go to Germany today, and in a city park, there's going to be people laying out naked on the grass. It's to a greater degree than you would see in a French or British or American city.
I went into a sauna in Germany one time wearing my shorts, and I got hissed at. Hissed.
Did you have a corset?
Hissed at. No, I was just wearing shorts in a sauna, and it was considered not just a breach of etiquette, but like unhealthy. Like I had brought typhoid into, and a woman, I swear to you, a woman in a nurse's outfit came into the sauna in response to the hissing and essentially grabbed me by the ear.
Yeah, you're ruining the vibes.
And said, get thou shorts off. And I was like, you're in
a nurse's uniform.
Yeah, you're like a, like a Frau Wittgenstein here. I don't want to get my shorts off. And she was like, shorts off.
That's because you were now the leering kid over the fence on the apple box.
Yeah, with my weird corset on. I need to get right with nature.
In the West, it becomes gymnosophy for a while, like from Latin roots meaning naked wisdom. Just the idea that, because there's some idea that this is what the ancients did, you know, that it's,
yeah,
we're getting back to the ideals of the Greeks and the Romans.
Yeah, although there was a lot of pedophilia involved in it.
Well, we don't want to necessarily associate that. I mean, and this, and you're kind of leaning into what the tension becomes here. It becomes renamed naturism and becomes a thing, popular thing among middle-class intellectuals who are all insisting that it's not a sex thing.
Right.
It's their main thing is to remind you that it's not a sex thing.
But this was also an era where there was a great expansion in sex things. Right? Like there was also a lot of...
Well, that's what happens.
A lot of social movement where it's like, actually, this is a sex thing.
So it seems like there's two strains. Like in these nudist camps and colonies and their yearly festivals, you know, there were hotels and big vacation spots that were known to be the naturist spot where you could wander around the lobby and the grounds naked. And they all had rules that seemed to be very much in keeping with their straight-faced insistence that this is not a sex thing. There's just
like
something beautiful
no
and freeing about... There is a no boners rule.
How do you enforce a no boners rule?
It's basically like, well, turn around or use your towel. Because one of the biggest rules is everyone has to have a towel at all times because it turns out that even naturists don't want to sit on a chair that have had 10 other naked people sitting on it that day.
So is this a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy situation?
I think it is. It might be a coincidence.
Uh-huh.
that both hitchhikers and naturists always need to have a towel with them.
Need to have a towel, yeah.
You got to know where your towel is. I mean, I think the main rule is no staring. You know, the main rule is like, fake it till you make it. Pretend that no one's naked until you've actually gotten over it. And then at some point your brain switches and no one is naked.
Yeah, right.
But you've got to get to that point. And as I said earlier, they all had the problem of like too many middle-aged guys who just wanted to play badminton naked, and that vibe was weird. So, and at the time there's enough homophobia that what they really want is to not seem limp-wristed by the standards of the time. So, you know, you got to bring your spouse. This is a spouse's only nudist colony. Because we don't want anyone to think that there might be any kind of, you know what, hanky-panky going on here.
These are the magazines that Hawkeye Pierce used to...
Okay, yes. And that's where the tension comes to a head, is in these magazines. In 1933, it wasn't just Hawkeye. Like, in World War II, nudist material was everywhere in the armed forces.
Because it could be it
was
legit.
It was a loophole in postal regulations against both printed material and films, because you could say that, you know, this is actually very important that we see these nude women playing volleyball or throwing a javelin because it's a healthy lifestyle.
And these guys in jeans that are forcibly showering a guy who stole a motorcycle.
Totally normal thing to do. And I think a lot of the stuff I've read has pointed out that, like, there was more winking at this after World War II. The World War II basically ruined America's anti-porn puritanism because all our boys were lonely overseas. And hey, what are you going to do?
Right. It's better than having sex with each other in a foxhole for the wives.
Or you know, the camp followers, the sex workers, wherever they're stationed.
Sure.
You know, like, this is the least of three evils.
Right.
The other two evils being... cheating on your wife or finding out you're gay in the trenches.
Right.
So these nudist outfits that would, you know, the International Nudist Conference, which later became the American Sunbathing Association and is now the leading naturist American, it's like the American Association of Nude Recreation. Because recreation is always a big part of the branding. You
which
know?
Is badminton, typically,
yeah,
right?
What are
they doing?
Yeah, volleyball or...
certainly not skiing.
There are pictures of nude German skiing from the Lebensreform movement.
I guess so.
And it's really
cold also.
It seems very uncomfortable because can you imagine if you fall? I mean, you're going to be cold all the time, but if you fall in a snowbank naked, you're going to die.
I've spent quite a bit of time in snowbanks naked.
Is that true?
Well, because it was part of our hot tub culture in Anchorage when hot tubs first exploded. You go into the hot tub and then when you get hot, you run out and throw yourself into a snowbank. And let me tell you, it hurts like hell.
You do not recommend.
No, it's pins and needles. It's really like, pins and needles, like emphasis on needles.
But like, not in a nice way, like my foot fell asleep, really as if a bunch of people are sticking needles into you.
Wait, you like it when your foot falls asleep? What kind of madman are you?
Well, people say it's a tingle. Like people don't, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but
it's a little...
It sucks.
I mean, hitting your funny bone's bad. The tingle of your foot falling asleep is... I don't know. To me, it's neutral. It is neither pleasure nor pain.
Well, it's not that. It's that kind of like...
It's pain.
It's like, ow, ow. I guess it's better than itching.
Better than itching.
Better than itching.
But that's not a good blurb for anything. Would you order the fried chicken again? Yeah, it's better than itching.
Try our umbrellas. Better than itching.
They don't cure itching, by the way. They're just better than if you were itching. In a different scenario. So these organizations had, you know, 15,000 members tops, and they quickly found that their publication, flagship publications, Sunshine and Health, and other magazines like it, were selling 50,000 copies. At newsstands around America, not to interested nudists,
right,
but to people who realized that there were airbrushed butt-naked women playing badminton therein.
At what point did we start to conclude that direct sunlight was not healthy?
Yeah, I think this, I wonder what the effect of that on nudism was. Because today you look at best practices for naturist getaways, and one of the main things they say is sunscreen, sunscreen, sunscreen.
Right.
We cannot emphasize this enough.
SPF 99.
Every year somebody screws this up and somebody has a bad time because they miss a spot or they, you know, don't reapply after the swim, the morning brisk swim. But
you've also seen Swedes who are like sun worshipers who tan until they are actually the color of tomatoes. Like these very blonde Europeans in Southern Europe who
and their
are just
skin
like,
is now darker than their hair.
Yeah, what are you? Wow, you're just so red. But it's like a, not a sunburn red. It's like a cooked red.
But I never follow up with them to see how many of them got melanoma either.
Yeah, I suppose not.
The it's often said in the literature that the reason why Scandinavia has less hang-ups about nudity is because they're less social. It's only in places with higher population density that the natural human tendency to skinny dip or nude sunbathe occasionally was replaced by the shame of what if somebody sees you.
Right.
In rural Sweden, you know nobody's going to see you, so the nudity persists.
Can confirm. Also, they prefer not to look at each other. So
yeah, no eye contact.
There would just be, you could have 40 Swedes on a nude beach and no one would even see the others.
So people like Hawkeye Pierce were buying 50,000 copies a month of these magazines.
Yeah.
And it made the post office angry. I think this came up in Tom of Finland, that there was a very anti-smut crusader postmaster general of the 40s and 50s named Arthur Summerfield. And he would use the full weight of his government bureaucracy against, you know, he prosecuted people who were mailing Aristophanes plays to each other because, Lysistrata is smutty. He was very worried that gay people might use the mails to find pen pals because, you know, they'd be too ashamed in the society of the time to find gay culture elsewhere.
And the Postal Service had its own police. So
yeah. And they would read people's letters to see if they could crack the code on gay pen pals. And they would take them to court for a violation of obscenity laws.
Crack the code on gay pen pals.
Of all the codes I would love to crack, I love cracking codes.
I know you do.
I feel like gay pen pals is... And that's not much of a feather in your cap.
Well, it's not hard to crack.
It's not. Well, we know about hanky codes.
Well, what if
they weren't subtle?
What if you went to like one of those puzzle rooms? What are those escape rooms?
Yeah.
Like you took me to one of those cocktail party style. Let's go in and.
Oh, yeah, I had a birthday party a few years ago. I forgot about that.
Let's go yell at each other about which one of these dumb light fixtures is actually a handle.
They were only yelling at you because you were messing with somebody's puzzle.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, and I cracked the code of gay pen pals.
Is that how we got out?
Yeah.
You can only get out of this room if you crack the code of gay pen pals.
Because everybody was trying to read some quizzical document, and I was over taking candles out of the candle, and then the door opened.
So this actually, these nudist materials would get around Summerfield's cops who were busting anybody who tried to send copies of Lady Chatterley's Lover, let alone dick pics, through the U.S. mail. And it finally went to court. Sunshine Book Company v. Summerfield, the Postmaster General and the nudists faced off. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, which found in favor of nudist material. And it kind of broke the ban on basically trying to enforce any obscenity laws at all through the mail. But the narrow wedge, the foot in the door was the naturist periodicals and their devoted following of Hawkeye Pierce types, because it did seem a little because they pushed their anti-sexualization vibe so thoroughly, you really could make the case that you were just admiring the beauty of the human form and they weren't doing anything untoward. What could be nicer than badminton, right?
Right.
There is kind of a dark side to this. I mean, you asked about, did the politics continue? You know, as it moved to the U.S., honestly, a lot of these German guys who emigrated to the U.S. after the war, Bill Pester, Benedict Lust, Arnold Ehret, they all kind of wound up in California, and they brought German Lebensreform-style communal living to California, and these were kind of the grandpappies of the hippie movement. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a direct line through these emigrants, post-World War II emigration, from German, hey, let's all have nude communes and grow our own food in the mountains, in the Alps, straight to, hey, what if we did that in Big Sur? Like, that's all the same guys. You know, you don't get hippie culture and their relaxed approach to clothing without the Nazis, basically.
The fog can get a little cold in Big Sur.
That's not where you'd put your nudist colony?
Nah, maybe not. Although there are lots of places you can hide from other people in Big Sur.
The fog is good if you want to, if you're feeling a little shy about your nudity, just vanish into a convenient bank of fog.
What's funny is that this was also like an era where there was an explosion of sexuality. So there also then needed to be beaches where you could look. Or maybe that wasn't beaches.
Well, that's what we're going to get to. Because that's kind of the main tension in naturism today. I guess the thing I was going to say is there was actually a lot of eugenicist writing in the U.S. Naturist tradition as well. You know, that this is how we further the species and weed out the weak. You know, it's...
Is what? Subject them to direct sunlight until they...
Yeah, get everybody so healthy via nude volleyball that... that those are the people who breed and survive. But there's actually an influential U.S. nudist named Maurice Parmalee, who also was like an influential sociologist and wrote the first American criminology textbook, weirdly.
Hmm.
He studied the criminal mind. But as early as 1931, he was writing, hey, all these eugenics creeps in the American nudist movement are bumming me out. The great thing about nudism is it should be progressive, like it should broaden beauty standards.
Oh, and not narrow them.
Yeah, like these people are like looking at the beautiful Greek statuary of the past and saying, ah, like let's aspire to that ideal in our nude form. And he's saying that was always a bummer that they had these impossibly idealized visions of the body that basically just make everybody feel bad. He kind of discovered body positivity in 1931 and said, the great thing about nudism is you look around and you realize everybody looks different. Everybody's represented. In particular, the big American Sunbathing Association was whites only.
Oh.
Well into the 1960s, opposed integration. And he was saying, the beauty of nudism is we're all the same. You should see black bodies and, you should see people of color there. And that's, you know, all those stigmata, all those stigmas should be gone.
I did mention, I think, that in my experiences of nudism, it is true that you get used to it really quickly and it seems very normal all of a sudden. And all the different bodies just seem not weird and not ugly, right? Every kind of shape of person, you're just like, oh, right. There, it does actually work that way. And then you feel dumb in clothes.
Like, oh, it actually goes the other way.
Yeah, you just are like, oh, well, how dumb.
Why do I have to go back to this stuff?
Yeah, this, and you just kind of see how dumb your clothes are.
I mean, that's what everybody says about nature.
Yeah, that happened to me too.
That there's just something about it. And if you don't try it, you can't understand it. And I guess you're a witness to that. That
I mean, this wasn't true when I was 8, but as a grown-up, right?
But there, you found there was some freeing appeal to it that could not be predicted or found by other means.
Yeah, just really, really quickly, it's not weird anymore.
Did you find it actively feels healthy and invigorating the way all this naturist propaganda always writes?
In the sense that with your clothes on, there's like so much you're judging other people, like, yeah. Oh, those pants that have fake hige on them, you know, whereas...
That's so you.
Whereas nobody in their naked body generally is anything other than just what... You just take it at face value.
And like, I think that was kind of the Marxist take on naturism. Now everybody's the same. You know, you can't tell the fancy clothes of the bourgeoisie from the working clothes of the peasant. Like,
well, and almost everybody has some aspect to their body that is not what you would see like a calendar of firemen. Right? Like even a bunch of naked firemen, you're going to be like, oh.
Yeah, even those people who have great bodies that probably have some hang up about their great body.
Well, and also there's something about their body that isn't, you know, that just seeing them in the world, like, oh, they're super handsome, but when they turn around, their butt's got dimples on it, like everybody.
Right.
And so there's not, you realize like a lot of nude photography.
I'm not the only one with this hang up. It's.
And then there's just such a kind of magnificent variation in people that fat doesn't seem weird.
Yeah.
You know, it's not ugly. It's just like, oh, sure, you've got lady lumps and...
Clothes are the problem.
Yeah, and I've got
Clothes are making my pot belly look weird.
Yeah.
I'm interested in this. My love handles are very interested in this.
You know, because so much of clothes now, at least, is, well, always, right, is about concealment.
Shapewear,
Oh,
I mean, the big conflict today is that naturism is... aging. You know, it was a lot of single guys and married couples of the boomer generation who liked to go hang out with like-minded people on the veranda.
Oh, but Gen Z is like never nudes, right? They're all mad that there was sex in Oppenheimer.
New Puritanism. And I think even studies of Europe are showing that the younger the person, the more resistant they are to clothing optional beaches and nude beaches. And like American, even though they like to tut-tut at our, you know, the prudish remnants of our Puritan origins, it's somehow probably via what we're talking about, the beauty standards of impossible beauty standards of capitalism and media are seeping in.
Well, and, you know, that, and also they never meet each other. Like young people,
you have to leave the house. Yeah.
You're just sending pictures, if anything.
Yeah.
And so you don't have that experience of like, I'm in a room.
You have cyberspace to be nude in.
Yeah. Like I just saw my first naked person.
And you can understand that young people will resist any activity that requires hanging out with a bunch of older folks. You can only imagine how much that's accentuated if everyone's naked. So a lot of these spaces are really having a hard time appealing to younger people. And as you point out, it does not match the new Puritanism. But on the other hand, there are things in its favor. You know, they were, as I said, ahead of the curve on body positivity.
Right.
Like this idea that, you know, that porn just, you know, produces this totally unrealistic idea of both anatomy and human sexuality. You know, Maurice Parmelee was writing about this in the 30s, saying, don't believe the Greek statuary. Don't feel bad about yourself because you don't look like the discus thrower or the Venus de Milo.
Although you'll notice that Greek statuary, it seems like...
Yeah, genital size is not a concern for them.
They're all growers, not showers.
And of course, the idea that now I think a lot of naturist spaces remind you how great it is not to have phones, you know, like...
Right.
You know, like all these other people always putting their hand in their pocket to reassure them that my precious is still there. You don't have pockets.
Well, that was what was weird. You know, you do see people with like shoulder bags, right? Like crossbody bags on the nude beach.
Look, it's a nude letter carrier.
Yeah, because you got to carry your suntan lotion somewhere, right? Your bottle of water.
And I know a lot of places reported a COVID era boom in nudity, I guess because everybody was looking for new things you could do outside.
Right. You can't conceal your COVID in your pocket.
But as I kind of foreshadowed, like what even is nudism now in an age where the sexual climate is more open? You know, you talked about this explosion of acceptability. Now a lot of people who are getting into nudism are not repressing whatever that sexual frisson was that they were pretending did not exist in Sunshine and Health magazine. You know, a lot of people are there for the swinging or for the cruising, you know, depending on who you are. And it's kind of caused a schism in the nudist community, whether, well, are we going to embrace the young people that are here to party, or are we going to hold tight to, this is a safe space for badminton. You need to take that somewhere else.
Well, you know, there is also a kind of weaponizing of nudity. Because there's so much since ACT UP, there's been a kind of very confrontational part of
the reason why gay pride parades have the open campy content.
It's
like an in your face to the straights that tried to repress that.
But then increasingly at the fringe, a real like, here's my Doniker in your face, and if you can't handle it, you're part of the problem type of. Like it's an iteration beyond just here's my natural body.
Right.
It's like here's my natural body on your forehead, and you know, and that isn't, not only is it not healthy for children and other living things, but also it doesn't come from an internally healthy place, right? It's confrontational. Right.
And you kind of wonder if it'll go away once the you know, the repression that produced it fades, you know, hoping that that will happen.
Right. And I wonder this is the Rousseauian problem, right? Of is that repression cultural or is there something to it? Natural or socially beneficial.
And there's certainly going to be some subset of people who enjoyed the illicit demimonde that they were you know,
oh, for sure.
that they were pushed into. And it's a little less fun now that everybody is celebrating.
But it's like a lot of that kind of nature versus nurture stuff where you, or just all the people who have been saying vegetarianism makes you live longer. We've talked about that. And it's like, well, it's that's been happening long enough that there should be some 130-year-olds. And there doesn't seem to be any. So, and also when you look at the 105-year-olds and go, how many of you are vegetarians? You know, the answer is like...
It turns out tofu was not the limiting factor.
And so I guess there's enough of this sense of, well, if nudism was really the way...
We would have discovered it by now.
Wouldn't the nudists have been...
taken over the world.
Or something. Wouldn't there have been some, at least, evidence? Like, even in a... Especially now that we live in a world where you can, hopefully, create systems where you avoid the pressures of the Catholic Church or whatever. Where is the great steam engine of nudism?
Well, you might... What you might wind up with is...
Even in terms of, like, Buddhist enlightenment, like, where are the nudists who are able to...
Buddhist and nudist?
Yeah, the nudist enlightenment.
I'm a Zen nudist.
Where's the transcendental hopping?
The thing about the Denny Blaine issue and controversy, which, by the way, the city backed down on immediately.
Did it really?
And the playground will be... Well, they had a open comments period, and 500 people showed up, and nobody defended putting a playground there.
I see, sure.
And I guess, you know, whoever, the anonymous donor did not bother to show up and be like, but my yacht.
But my anonymity. But then that's another thing about the traditional politics, right? 500 people are enough if there aren't 500 other people.
Yeah, that's why pickleball is taking over. but the thing about this is that it turns out there is no law against public nudity in Seattle.
No, there's not. That's right.
Unlike most cities, it's okay. Have you ever had naked encounters in Seattle? Like, there were a bunch of nude bicyclists up on Kite Hill in Gasworks Park a while ago when I was there with the kids. And they were kind of like, bleh. And well, I was like, oh, I guess that's Seattle in the summer, baby.
We always have the solstice parade where everybody's naked.
Yeah.
But Capitol Hill used to have those... there was a couple, a guy who was like 5'4", who had big curly kind of gray hair, and his boyfriend who was like 5'11", and he walked him on a leash. The little one walked the big one on a leash, and they, depending on the season, were often half naked.
Speedo?
Well, no, chaps with no under layer. And it was just part of Seattle's great diversity at the time, although it was very openly. It wasn't aggressive. It was just very much like, we're on this, you know, like we're weirdos and that's great.
Well, maybe that's the future of nudism is like it's no longer camps and colonies and weekend getaways for a small group of enthusiasts. It's just something you might come upon in on a city park.
But it's like taking mushrooms. You don't want to do it downtown. You want to go somewhere where the wind
where
is
the
blowing.
Vibe is better.
Yeah, you don't like...
That's what Denny Blaine is for.
Exactly.
I think the one factor that might actually save naturism is a warming planet.
Oh.
If we get 2 or 3 degrees centigrade warmer, what's the explosion in nudity as a result? It might be a million people for every 0.1 degree that global temperatures rise. Who knows?
So the global temperature goes up 3 degrees, and then in winter in Seattle, it's 56 degrees instead of 53. I don't know if there's going to be more nudism. And that concludes Naturism, entry 827.GE0225, certificate number 53668 in the omnibus. Futurelings' social media died long enough ago that we never really got to see the naturist side of social media. There was a lot of porn on there, but there wasn't a lot of healthy nudism, was there?
I don't know. I never...
There must have been.
If there was... I mean, because you didn't need, you know, the rubberneckers, you know, they could get their real porn somewhere else.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure the naturist societies of Devon and Provence and West Virginia were still... had their online clubs and meetings and Facebook groups.
Well, but as you said, if you're at the naturist beach, you're not on your phone. You're not taking pics.
That's the beauty of it. Yeah, cameras not encouraged at nudist gatherings.
Well, if you want to see people fully clothed doing things, you can still find them on my Instagram at John Roderick. And Ken, are you still making jokes on Twitter?
No.
All right, what are you posting there? Anything?
Nothing.
God, you were so good on Twitter. You really were.
I loved what Twitter was, but thank you. But I feel people aren't even doing promotion on it anymore.
No, why would you?
I don't think Jeopardy has been promoting stuff on Twitter, and you know they just switched to their other channels, Instagram and whatnot.
I had 40,000 followers, and congrats. Now nothing. Yeah, you say congrats with your little sneer as a 250,000 or how many people were following you or are?
Yeah, it was 500,000.
Half a million.
Nearly. I said it like to minimize it. I had a mere half of my unit, which was 1 million followers.
You can still, if you go back in Ken's timeline 8 years, you will find some funny tweets. I don't think you can find mine anymore. There were some really good ones, though.
I think mine are probably gone, too. I don't even know how Twitter archives.
You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can send us mail at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. It looks like you've got some mail, Ken. Is that right? A box?
Yes.
Cards? Boxes and cards?
Austin likes Omnibus and works for an independent board game company.
Okay.
Do you like games that are visually and playfully engaging?
My daughter does.
You don't.
I like to be left alone.
And a board game would be the opposite of that.
It's the opposite. You really have to really engage.
My hobby would be not playing board games. Easy to learn board game, but you might enjoy their indie board game Cultivate, which is, you know, how cults often come up on Omnibus, including in this very show. Cultivate, you play as a cult leader working to fill your compound with followers. But watch out, rival cult leaders may try to sabotage you or convert the followers you can't keep in line.
Oh my God, I do not want my daughter to see this
game. Well, look at this beautiful mid-century design.
It's
like,
so beautiful.
It's great.
But this feels like an adult cocktail party game. The idea...
I think it's family friendly.
Introducing my daughter to more sense that you can form a cult around yourself is not
Maybe this will be a healthy. This will be a healthy outlet for those impulses.
I think it will just encourage her on her path to being a dangerous force.
Yeah, thank you for sending
that.
Yeah,
that is a beautiful thing.
If anybody here wants to see this game we're describing so glowingly, it's Pops and Bijou Games, POPSBEJOU.com.
Look who just walked in, Ken.
They just sent us a board game about cult leaders. Do you want to play a board game about cult leaders?
And I said I was not going to let you play it because you were already trending that way. Here, do you want to say hi to the Omnibus people?
Head shake.
Hello.
Well done. And you have, what are those little rubber bands in your mouth? That's a new development.
Braces.
Oh my God, that's so cute.
Did you just come from the orthodontist? Yeah,
she said braces suck. It's not wrong. And you can, in addition to supporting us by sending us board games that are degenerate, you can support the show directly at patreon.com/omnibusproject, which we encourage you to do. And coming up soon in 2024, there will be even more reason to join the Omnibus. So join now because you're, depending on the date that you join, it's like your REI number.
That's right. You want
the lowest REI number you can have.
But it's not like Microsoft stock number where it might be worth millions of dollars to you to have the lowest number.
No, it's true.
It's just a point of pride.
It's just a point of pride when you're standing at REI and you're like, oh my God, your number starts with a zero. It's like, that's right. That's right, kid. Ring up my snowshoes or whatever.
It's the opposite of having a car where you don't want the oldest license plate.
You don't?
I don't know.
Oh, I was going to do an episode on this. Well, save it. I'll save it.
I'm interested in that.
Yeah.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, the nudists are in trouble.
You think they're the first to go?
Well, there's not a lot of natural disasters where you wish you were nude. Certainly not volcano eruption.
My sister believes it's going to be solar flares. And yeah, if you're out there nudisting and suddenly the solar flare...
You're just going to be a shadow on the badminton court.
That's right.
If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.